Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. And this is Gather Round. And tonight we have two guests coming in. They'll be talking about the new shows starting up actually on the stations this week. So Ken Withrow and Steve Katz will be here. At the top of the next hour, Sarit Jacobson's here with a view on the world and lots going on. One thing that we will be talking about is some... I'm trying not to use certain words so much anymore, but anyway, some terrorists in Gaza blew up Gaza's Ark, and it's like half sunk now, so we will be talking about that more. Today is National Raisin Day, and if you're like me, raisins are a favorite in trail mix, not so much in cookies. In raisin bread, though, I love raisin bread, but I've been putting sunflower seeds, raisins, and unsweetened coconut together for a trail mix kind of thing. And let me tell you, it's really good. So enjoy National Raisin Day every day, just like Earth Day. Every day should be Raisin Day. I did want to mention tonight that this week we saw the 28th year since Chernobyl, and you know, that this was something that for years was kept hidden. I mean, everybody finally knew that, you know, it blew, but they haven't known the extent of the damage to humans and the area. So now there's a lot of this out, and I suggest that you check YouTube or, you know, read some articles, because you will see it's... It's really terrible that the people, you know, the Russians at first, they just said that like 28 people had died. These were like first in, but there's been thousands died and even more thousands affected their health for the rest of their lives. So it's worth checking out, because heaven knows we don't need another one. We've got to get away from this nuclear power. And we know we have alternatives. They're ready. We've had wonderful inventors who've come up with things, but for one reason or another, mainly capitalistic greed, we aren't taking advantage of them. So, you know, there's a lot people can do, and they can convince some of these corporations, while we still have corporations, that they can actually make money of doing something right, instead of stripping the earth. So it's something to think about. And there's plenty of work for all of us who actually care about the planet. Today is, well, in the South Hemisphere, if you're in the Sohem, you're going to be celebrating Samhain tonight, which is called Halloween in the North. And in the Nohem, we have Beltane, which is a good pagan holiday that goes way, way back. It's a fire festival. It's a fertility festival. This is where the maypole dance comes from. And where I was growing up, we made May baskets. And it was just part of, we did it at school. We did it at Sunday school. We did it at home. And it wasn't until I grew up and left that small town that I found out that everybody in the country doesn't do May baskets. But ours were usually made out of construction paper, a little square box or a cone. You know, you rolled the construction paper, tape it or glue it. And the filler of choice was popcorn. So lots of popcorn in there. A few pieces of candy. And this time of year, there were small spring flowers. So we would gather little flowers like violets and put in the basket. And we gave these to our parents. We gave them to our friends, our Sunday school teachers, our neighbors. But the big thrill was to take a May basket to your somebody. Now we're talking, you know, youngsters. Somebody you had a crush on. And in my case, it was a boy across the street for a few years. And you ring the bell, you hang the basket, if it has a little handle, you hang it on the doorknob or put it right down by the door. Then you go around the side, you know, make sure he comes out and sees you. Then you run. He chases you, catches you, and kisses you. And so this, both sex, whatever. So all this time, you know, growing up in a pretty, I don't want to say it wasn't fundamental. It was fundamental, but it wasn't crazy, crazy like fundamental Christian churches. But, you know, you never even had a clue that this had anything to do with fertility rituals. And I just find it so funny that, you know, as children, we were doing this. So May Day, the 1st of May, always brings back these memories for me. And also, May Day is the workers' day. So for everybody who is even slightly aware that at like the United States, we only have about 6 or 7% of workers are in unions, it's time to really think about what the unions have given us, like no more child labor, 40-hour week, things like this, because I know a lot of people say, well, what good are they? You know, we should just outlaw them completely. But there's so much, and there's so many things that the workers still need and can do. So think about that. There's two reasons, you know, for me anyway, to celebrate the 1st of May. And one is BLTNA, or May Day, and for the pagan roots, the fun, the festivities, and then also Workers' Day, which is very important. And now that we are becoming such a global international community, we're seeing how workers are exploited around the world, and many of them from companies that are based, or at least a lot of money is here in this country, the United States, where I am. So just keep opening your eyes, because it's going to be amazing this year and next year. We were really on the start of a major role. So I'll stop talking about that now, and I'm going to bring in our first guest, who is Ken Withrow, and he is from Green Farms A&M, now Prezo,
Indiana.
Hey, hi, how are you, Ken?
I am good. How are you?
Hey, me too. I agree. George is in the chat room, and he's talking about, he's in New York, there's too much rain, a lot of rain, and we have been having our share. The neighbor who does tilling told me today, because we were looking over, I want some more land tilled up, is way too wet now. He said, you know, he doesn't know how long it's going to be, because it's really, really wet here. It's got to dry out some. So I don't know.
I've been kind of having that issue.
Yeah.
We had a long, slow winter with lots and lots of snow. So we got our frost line finally just cracked, and now we're getting not a lot of rain, but it's a cold rain. So like, I'm not even turning soil over yet on my, you know, in-ground crops. We just left it. A lot of us are talking about just waiting. A little bit longer.
That's I know. You know, usually here we think about the last frost date kind of thing. You know, they say between the 1st of May, 10th of May, whatever. But now we're not even really worrying about that. We're worrying about the moisture. Yeah. So.
Yeah, it's you can drown a lot of your stuff, and you know, the more wet crops will flourish, but you know, not a good time to be throwing a lot of food in the ground. It's cold and wet. It thing. Yeah. The seeds don't even want to wake up most of the time. Kind of why I moved over to vertical farming. It's just I could predict what I'm going to cause.
Yeah. Why don't you
safer.
Talk a little bit about Green Farm A&M? What do you do? Yeah.
All right. Well, roundabout, I'm automation engineer and a chemist, and I have a very large family. I have 6 children, and I am, kind of started by needing a way to feed them and got into indoor farming, hydroponic. And then because I'm a chemist and an automation engineer, I'm a nerd. So I wigged out on it and took it as far as I could with a couple partners. And now we have this really high yield, all natural indoor vertical farm where we use LED and fluorescent lights, and we grow produce for universities and schools, restaurants. Just now in the middle of finishing up a deal with some investors, and we'll be doing much more large wholesale single-point buyer stuff. And we kind of, because also, aside of being nerds, we're absolute activists, we wanted to tackle all the problems of modern agriculture, which you were just talking about, Juan. The weather. The weather dictates the prices, and the prices can either cause inaccessibility of healthy food or too much healthy food getting stashed somewhere and then rotting and being thrown away instead of going where it should. So we wanted to eliminate those things, and alongside of chemicals, heavy equipment, soil runoff, subsidy crops for things that people can't eat, and which then, just sustains the problem of the fuel industry and us not pursuing better power alternatives for vehicles and homes. And so it just kind of, we wanted to go after it all, and we ended up with what we do now, which is sell things at or below market price that are all natural, harvested the day of or the night before of the delivery, and we keep low distribution radius, like each farm can't go within more than an hour from where it sits, and it's a clean room process too, so like we've limited pesticides, like everything. It's just hydroponic nutrients or aquaponic. We may use fish. And we, basically cut out everything. Everything possible that, large companies like Monsanto or Del Monte can use as their argument to back their practices. We've eliminated everything.
Yeah. I think that's
kind of it.
Yeah, well, and you're a California boy when you came to the West. And when you left California, did you have any idea you'd be doing something like this?
I had no clue. No, I was an art student at Santa Cruz, just got out of the military, grew up surfing, skateboarding, playing guitar, smoking pot, like everything you would expect someone like me to have done. And then I decided I didn't want to pay a university a ton of money to teach me something that was my life passion. So I figured I'd pay a university something that I wasn't really sure how to dive into, which was biology and physics. And then I found that Purdue had a really good program and had an opportunity to move to Indiana, which I had only been to Indiana once before, and I don't remember any of it. It was a blip while we were driving through to other states and better places. So the Midwest never clicked. I knew Chicago and St. Louis, I don't know anything about the Midwest. And when I got here, I was right in steel mill country. It was awful, and it was backwards and nothing I knew. And it freaked me out for a good 3 months before I found people and realized I love the area. And that was in 92, and I have never left. I've been here ever since.
Yeah.
Kind of weird.
When I remember, because I grew up in Illinois, and not where I am, but it seemed like when we would go to Indiana, it would feel like we were back 25 years. somehow.
It was like
and back at that time, it hadn't really caught up. But
it
now,
was, it blew me away. The racism really kind of shocked me. I am in the Bible Belt, and so there's that too. And I'm kind of go against the grain of that realm of thinking, but the racism was what really blew me away, because I grew up in a very integrated, I grew up around Oakland, so it was a very integrated community.
Sure.
And we were all, you're either poor or you had money and didn't live there. So when I came out here, I had just heard so much crap I've never heard before, and I felt like I went back 20, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very weird thing, but then it got me angry, and I'm like, I felt my experience could be used, and instead of just staying angry, like trying to be part of a solution. And I think that's what kickstarted everything. I got into flipping houses in Gary and community projects, got into activism, and then the environmental stuff started coming along, and it just sort of all jumbled together, and next thing you know, I'm here as a agricultural advocate and innovator thing, I guess. And this is weird. Never saw it coming.
I think that's wonderful because it just takes one event happening to get you on a whole path that was totally not imagined just a few years before. I love the way life does this to us. Because life happens in life, but it's a collaboration, I think, between us and the universe. And now, coming from this kind of background, you, facilitating a show here Monday nights at 7 o'clock called The Dialogue. You want to tell us a bit about it and how you have come to have these people, this circle. Yeah.
Wow, that's an additional weird story. So, let me see. We go back. I'll start with the Midwest. So I moved out here, went through a divorce after college, had three kids at the time, and ended up kind of pretty much taking care of my three boys and dropped everything and went and took a job in the steel mill. During that time, I was driving from my ex-wife's, my old house, to my apartment in Valparaiso, in the town I live in now, and I would pass this old house, this old farmhouse, huge, giant old house, and it always got my attention. Like, driving by, it was like when you drive by a car wash and there's women out there in bikinis trying to get you to car. Like, it was like that. Like, I could not shake my eyes from it. And finally, one day, about noon, the highway, this is a major highway in front of it, too, and it was dead. There was no cars on there. And there's a sign out in front saying rent 13 rooms, 900 a month, whatever. And I called the number, and the guy that owned the place happened to be there. And it was full of raccoons, squirrels, and junk. It was horrible, and I loved it. And everything said, I need to be there, and I don't know why. Now, I ended up working a deal with them, and me and my partner now, Julie, and at the time we had a couple kids plus my older, I brought them in. We looked at the place. I spent 3 months fixing it up and ended up moving in. And from there is kind of when all of a sudden all this intuitive stuff started occurring. The house was haunted. That was one of my biggest cues. The ghost hunters came out like three times before I moved in. They kept asking to come back. It was really interesting. They let me sit in on one of the things and started getting into the history of the property. And I'm just like, this is incredible, And so during that, I started noticing a lot more just odd things going on in my own life. Just ideas would pop. Here's a really weird one. You're going to like this. So with Green Farms, the system we designed, it's a mixture of what's called NFT and flood and drain. And the way we came up with it, we were in the dining room of this house working on it for hours and hours and hours, 2 to 3 times a week, sometimes upwards of 12 hours a day. On our free time between work, we would design this thing and the whole business model, everything. While we were designing this, I had found out that there, we thought we could only find only no one else doing our system, and I found out someone did, and this was like a couple years after we designed it, and it goes way back to World War One. There was an engineer, a female engineer, and she designed a similar system to feed the troops on the deserted islands, and her last name was Withrow, and it's called the Withrow Method. So I'm just like, am I, like, tapping my ancestors here or what, you know? And it was just crazy, the things that would occur on this property. And so I got really intrigued. And these are the lightweight ones. I'm talking crazier stuff that occurred, you know? And I just got really intrigued into what was going on with this place. And then one day I had a bunch of friends over. We were hanging out. And this area on the property, right in the center, and it just felt really good, and we thought it was odd, so we kept dabbling with it, messing with it, going back in there, you know, like, guys would go get stoned, whatever. I would meditate, whatever we could do to figure out what was going on, and come to find out, we found an active hotspot, and I started getting psychics involved, and that was when the group sort of started to form, and it kind of came out of me just waking up one day and having to work on the spot. So I unburied it, and I found a circle of a golden mean spiral of giant boulders, like huge stones buried under the ground. We were sitting on the tops of these.
Wow.
And it, you know, and then I found too that there was some math within it that lined up from going north, a 90-degree angle off of one of the boulders out of the center of the spiral, and then cut over and between the center of the spiral and the end of the curve of the ratio was a vortex. Like, psychics would, I had 3 different guys tell me. One felt a white column of light. Another guy, his arm went numb, his left. And another person got really, she's pregnant, got really dizzy. I didn't even tell her what she was standing on. And had to leave. And when I would close my eyes and meditate on it, I'd see, like, puffs of light in all the chakra colors. And it was kind of like a cloud, and it would spin clockwise. And I thought that was significant. Wasn't sure why until later digging. So it all blew me away. And all of a sudden, I started feeling a need to find a woman. I don't know why that was the feeling, but it was just something, and I couldn't shake it. Find a woman who understands this. So I started just paying attention as I got in conversations and all the, you know, the weird sites. I started talking to different psychics, channels, anything and everything, just looking for somebody to help me figure this out, you know. And at the time, I'd been getting into some esoteric reading and stuff, but nothing, you know, nothing was cluing me in. And then one day I ended up having this weird feeling to contact this work woman. And I did, and she ended up being way beyond what I expected of intellect and nerded out as bad as I did on all this stuff. She came up and stayed for a week, and we ended up, I went through, like, the most heavy-hitting spiritual journey you could imagine, and when I came out of the back end of that, we had discovered some crazy stuff, and it initiated a research project on basically the Freemason, the plundering of spiritual sites all over the U.S. tied to a lot of the mound structures, Hopi, Hopewell, Mayan, like all this stuff, and tied to, like, basically how the founding fathers manipulated the people and smothered all the cultures that had already been here, Native American primarily, but mm-hmm. Chinese, African, Norse, Irish, you know, everybody that had been here prior to the founding fathers. they buried all that culture and then put it, it kind of gave it a mask of manifest destiny and got the people to pretty much back it. And then the Smithsonian buried all this. We found through all the digging from this that that. And so then we're like, okay, now what? And we realized we got to do something. And mind you, there's a million more details. You know, this is the quickest way I could get through this. And so then I started with her and started really learning how to listen to my higher self, to my gut. And all of a sudden, I started noticing the same radar blips as I did with this first woman. And we ended up, I started kind of sniffing out people that just got it. And I would have conversations, you know, like when you and I talk. Right. And you just kind of all of a sudden you're like, oh, this person does get it. You know, not they're not caught up in the fluff, you know, or they're not too angry or too, they're absolutely on the path. And they get that they don't get anything, and they're not the bright, you know, you don't have to be a genius. You just have to know how to listen to your higher self, and you got to understand that every single thing in our history, in all the philosophies, every religion, every doctrination has been smothered, contorted, convoluted, buried, whatever, and is not its true original source. So finding these people, we realize that we need to do something together, and they're all over the states. Like, I found them all over the place. You know, Maryland, Washington, Arizona, you know, Pennsylvania, Illinois, you know, so, and I found a ton right here in the region, and they're all people like me who came here and couldn't leave for whatever reason, and now there's, like, this huge pocket of gifted, aware people not knowing what to do. And so we ended up trying to come up with something, and the dialogue sort of happened from that, just a need to at least start talking. And that's basically what this show is us going, okay, now that we're all in a room together, basically, you know, via phone, let's tackle these subjects we keep doing by ourselves on the phone, you know, and on Facebook and email and physically and whatever. And so we're the bunch of, you know, spiritually inclined people that have a lot of special gifts and special skills from jobs they've done and whatnot else, you know, and we are all actively pursuing creating a better world and know that science, government, philosophy all have to be tied to spirituality. And how do we do that in a world where that is not allowed? So that's kind of where this came out of, I guess. I don't know. Was that clear? It seemed kind of like a jumbled all over it, but
yeah, well, it totally makes sense to me because I you know,
you're part of it,
right? But if anybody has anything they want to say, George, I know you're listening. I you're in chat, but if you're actually on the board, tell us. Did that make sense? George is into metaphysics, and he would, if it makes sense, he will let us know. But it does. And, you know, there's something that is just truly such a great feeling when you find people you can talk to and you don't have to go back to basics. I have a few friends like that, and it's just, you know, besides the group, and it's wonderful when you don't have to go do a 101 kind of thing. I'm working on patience in this lifetime, and I'm better than I used to be, but I do get impatient, and that's what I told somebody several years ago, that, like, you know, I don't think I'm going to be teaching Wicca 101 anymore because I just don't feel like it. That's what, like, it's wonderful when, because there's people who will, and they're great at it, and that's good. I want to be able to pick up the phone or go online and have somebody there that knows what I'm talking about without me building the foundation again. So
yeah, it's nice to have a conversation past the basics. That was the other thing. I couldn't find anyone past the basics And I spent my life studying the basics, you know? I went from a very violent, angry Baptist church household to me being a complete atheist to me going, I don't get this either. I need to be agnostic. I think I, you know, approach it scientifically. And so I studied everything, and I studied it as wholeheartedly as I could. And I realized that the mystery schools are where it's at. It's in that hidden knowledge that the church was trying to destroy. You know, it's kind of like the follow the money concept. You know, follow what they're trying to smother, and you probably have what you're looking for. And so I just did that. And to talk to people and have to keep re-explaining that, I don't have any way to bounce ideas and theories off. And this is, this group was so necessary for my own spiritual growth because it's completely and utterly intellectual debate. It's all, I have to have someone check and balance me as much as I need to be able to just bounce crazy, stupid ideas off people and then go, no, that really is a dumb idea, and be like, okay, cool, you know, I can mark that one off. And
That whole think tank thing, if, you know, you throw everything out there, and when you're just going around, you know, you don't be too quick to judge, well, that's stupid, because there may be a part of that that fits in with a part of this, and, you know, you get something going. Right now, we're talking about a moneyless society. And Monday night, we were a hit on Monday night, and so we're going to do part two this coming Monday night, right?
Yeah, I'm hoping. It just seemed like that was such a catalyst, because to talk, you know, it was nice to leave the subject that open. I'm really happy that we ended up doing that. Because, you know, if you dictate too much, we don't know where it's going to go. And, like, trying to be intuitive people, we wanted to sort of let that happen. And it's really neat where it went, you know? I mean, we never even got down to solutions. We just absolutely talked about the very basic concept of what money causes, problem-wise, and then just very basic minor, not even solutions, just like this will cause this is this, and just thinking into it. So now I'm wondering where we're going to go with it now that we kind of all found a platform, and now we can go, okay, so what do we do? And it seemed like Angel probably he was the last one to really get to begin to dig in, but we didn't, I think we only got about maybe 10-15 minutes into solutions. I'm excited. That'll be cool to see what everyone got a week.
Yeah, there may be, like, many times, it's not an either-or. There may be several solutions that could work together.
There's a million.
One solution. Yeah. And I wanted to say, as far as I know, the six people who were here Monday night will be here this coming Monday, plus Kara.
Kara's coming in. I talked to her, too, today. It was kind of funny. I'm glad that you pushed it, and we ended up talking. I want her involved. She is one of the most gifted psychics I've ever met. It's all I can say. And this girl just is really, she amazes me with what she could pick up. And for her age, she's so young. And I'm thinking, God, imagine 20 years from now, the skills, you know?
She's
astoundingly smart already. It's just nice.
The show, it was good for us. And it was good for our listeners, too. This is the thing, because we were thinking, well, you know, we can all just talk on Google Plus or something, but why not put it on a show and let other people hear and see what they think, too. So I just want to thank you, Ken, for coming up with this, and thanks for coming in tonight. A little bit of your background, because you are facilitating this. And
it's kind of weird. I didn't think about it that way.
On Monday nights here on Aramark APO at 7 o'clock Central Time. So I will see you there then, my friend.
Yes.
Thanks a lot.
Yes. No problem. I'll talk to you. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
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 Steve Kurtz here.
So now we have Steve. And Steve is starting a show tomorrow called UFO, Paranormal, and Mystical Insights. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
I am good. So I was just talking with Ken about, in a little background, and what got him interested. He was gathering people around him, you know, talking on the phone, and decided, well, maybe we should all just talk together. It seemed a better way of doing it. So I wanted to ask you, because you come from background of psychology, and you're an attorney. How did you get interested in the mysticism and, like, the UFOs, all things paranormal, this kind of thing? How did this come about?
Well, I mean, the UFO interest came a long time ago when I was growing up in the 1950s. You know, and that was when we had a lot of sightings being reported to, you know, around the country. And actually, it really started right after World War II, which was when I was born. But, I mean, in the next decade, UFO sightings increased quite a bit. Books started coming out about it. Movies started being made about it. And, you know, I got interested in it. I was fascinated by the the idea that we have intelligences coming into the atmosphere of our own planet, or some types of entities that nobody seems to be able to, at least at that time, clearly determine what they were. And then that just led naturally into the mystical and the paranormal. Now, the mystical, when I was an undergraduate in the 60s, I had a philosophy teacher who I became friendly with, and we reconnected in the 90s. By then, he had been deeply got into mysticism. His name was Dr. Robert Passati, and unfortunately, he passed away in December of 1999. But for several years, we corresponded, and he became my kind of like my guru or mentor in mystical studies. And a very unusual man. And so these things have just sort of flown, kind of flowed together. And, you know, it always caught my attention, because I felt that the pedestrian reality that we're in every day, that there was something vital missing from it. And I guess that's what I was looking for.
Right, because once you get that feeling, like, there was an old song I've heard, something about, is that all there is? That was what I think a lot of us who are interested in this felt, that, you know, there has to be more. And so you were very fortunate to have, like, an actual mentor in the mysticism.
Yes, that kind of happened naturally. And he started suggesting books, and one of the major books he suggested was Major Trends in Jewish Mysticism by Gershom Scholem, who was a professor of mysticism at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. And Evelyn... who wrote a book on mysticism. Can't think of her last name right now. And, of course, both of us were very interested in Wilhelm Reich. And Wilhelm Reich, who was a student of Freud's, went into a lot of different areas. He was a brilliant scientist, went far beyond the realm of psychology, and he became very interested in UFOs. Up in Maine in the early 1950s, that was that same era, and he wrote a book. His last book was on, called Contact with Space, and it dealt with his experiences with UFOs in Arizona when he went out there to do some experiments. So, you know, and it was very helpful. Of course, my interest predated Dr. Passati, but he helped me quite a bit in the sense that he pointed me in different directions with the literature, and we had a whole discussion going on. We used to correspond. We corresponded for between 1996 until he passed away at the end of 1999. And if anybody's interested, all of these topics are covered in a book that I wrote, and then I also included the correspondence in there. It's called Wilhelm Reich, Liberation Theologian of Cosmic Energy, and it's published by McLeod Publishing. So if you get Google McLeod, you can get in there, and I have it in hardback, and of course it's in a digital copy. The digital copy is quite inexpensive if you're interested in taking a look at it, and that contains the entire set of correspondence which I saved and edited. And it also has an introductory essay to it. So, and it deals with mysticism, it deals with UFOs, politics, psychology, religion, and so on.
It's all interconnected. The more you get into
it. It's all interconnected, yeah. It's all interconnected.
You see, I mean, it's not just in a compartment over here. The lines between, the roads between, I mean, it's the myriad of connections.
Yes.
So the more you learn, the more you know there's so much more and you want to learn. And sometimes it's like, okay, I just need to go take a walk for a few days. And,
your
mind has to sort things to an extent because there's so much. And we're so fortunate to be living now when we have all this, I mean, out there. It's not like way back. Like you were talking about Jewish mysticism. I mean, way back, only certain people knew it or could study it.
Right.
Just like any of the mystery schools. I mean, a lot was passed down actually word of mouth for, centuries.
Right.
But then when, just certain people could read, certain people could do this. And now, I was going to say, well, almost everybody can read and write, although what I see every day, it totally convinced me people can't write, but you know what I'm saying. The tools are there. And I don't know. I always think of, when I hear mysticism, I do think of Jewish mysticism, but I don't know anything about it. The book that was actually very good for me was called The Garden of Pomegranates by Israel Regardi. And it's about the Tree of Life. And
oh, that's a wonderful book. I read that. I like Israel Regardi very much.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, great. Yes, me too. It's like, okay, I can get this.
Yeah.
But I heard kinds of things about Kabbalah, that there was a time when only men were supposed to study it, and they needed to be 35 years old or something because they thought by then they would have a family, and they'd be more settled, and they could handle
right.
it better.
Yeah.
Has that changed? I mean, like, officially, can anybody study it? I mean, people do, but would you say that?
Well, there's basically, there's two mainstreams, what I call the Western Hermetic Kabbalah, which is the Kabbalah which Bob was into and which I follow, which I study, and that did come from the traditional Jewish Kabbalah, but then it kind of expanded out beyond it, and it got into the English-speaking world, and it got into various, it became part of the curriculum of various what you would call mystery schools. But Dr. Regardi, who is a chiropractor by trade, and also who had a he went through Reich in therapy, and he was very interested in Reich as well. But he was in an original school called the Golden Dawn School,
right?
And His mentor was a man named Aleister Crowley, who got a lot of yellow press in Great Britain, and it was somewhat of a I don't know how to say it. He was kind of like his promoter. He did a lot of outrageous things because he wanted to bring people's attention to all this stuff. And it was Victorian time, so, it was a very repressed era. So when he came out and started doing all this stuff, he caused a lot of shock among conventional society.
Controversy, yeah. And a lot of things, right, like you said, he did things just to bring people's attention, but he would say things. I mean, I still fight people over Crowley because they say, well, he was advocating killing babies. I said, absolutely.
No.
He was talking about masturbation, you nut. I mean, read what he wrote.
Exactly.
He's been so demonized. And now if you say his name among some people, I mean, they know nothing about him, right? But like you said, the yellow press.
Well, he's kind of faded into history, but like in older generations, his name was associated with what I call the yellow press. Like Rupert Murdoch type yellow press, lurid stories. Had he come along in a later era, like the 1960s, he would have been much more accepted. If not accepted, he would have been much more understood by the general society.
Yes.
And that would have been a lot less. He was kind of the Timothy Leary of his day. But, Timothy Leary came up in an era of a great expansion of personal freedom during that time. There were conflicts, of course, but just talking about the counterculture. And, Aleister Crowley was kind of like the great granddaddy of the counterculture. He experimented with hashish, and he traveled around the world, and he was into all these Eastern disciplines and, all this stuff. And so that's how Regardé got, originally he read a few of his books and he wrote them, and Crowley said, well, why don't you come over to France where I am, and, you could be my secretary, because he used to... do a lot of writing, and he published a lot of stuff, most of it on his own. Crowley was the heir to a beer fortune, believe it or not. His family in England in the 19th century, they had a beer company, I guess, like Budweiser is here today. I don't know what the name of it was there. But, the British always drank a lot of beer, and... So Crowley never really had to work for a living for quite a long time as a young man. And, he was in, not Oxford, the other one. There's two major private universities there. There's Oxford, Edinburgh, I think. Anyway, he went three-quarters of the way through there, and then he got into all this stuff, and he spent his life writing a lot of this stuff down. You can get his books. They've been published in paperback, a lot of them. And it's not like, unfortunately, he did not have the same facility as his student book, Regardé, in that his writing, is turgid and it takes a while to decipher. Regardé wrote very clearly. It was much more... You can understand them a lot better.
He's your friend, but that's and also I believe that Crowley's background. I mean, actually, with his family, his mother was a little unusual or unhappy or strange. I think they had a strange relationship.
I think back, his father, I believe, was quite religious. I forget the religion, but it was kind of a puritanical religion.
It was a strict, yes, some kind of puritanical thing, which is strange then to, you know, because Alistair totally broke out. That was why he did. But I had read, I believe, that his mother, you know, the 666 thing? That she had, like, called him the beast, or she said he was a devil or something. I mean, it seemed like it was not a happy relationship. I should check that out again.
That I don't recall.
No.
666, I recall. I don't recall what the relationship with his mother, however. That I don't recall.
Well, he wrote a book called 666. He wrote a book called 777. He wrote a lot of books. I think, and then he, you know, then you can get into Gurdjieff, who's a favorite of mine, Walt Uspensky and Gurdjieff. I mean, they're just totally something else.
He's somebody I can't claim a lot of familiarity with, except to say that Henry Miller writes about him, you know, the novelist. Henry Miller apparently ran into him, and, I read a few things about him, but I don't have the same degree of knowledge of his work by any means.
Well, Uspensky, who was a student of his, he wrote a few things that actually rang with me and exercises to do. And I mean, we were just talking about all this knowledge is there, and it's not that hard to get. I wanted to ask you, Ian, the book you wrote is called William Reich, what?
Wilhelm Reich, Liberation Theologian of Cosmic Energy.
Okay, liberation. All right.
That could be ordered from Cloud Publishing, which is a company that basically permits you to do self-publishing. But there is also an excerpt from it that you can read, you know, for free on my blog called Harbors for Life. And on Harbors for Life, there's also a piece that I've written on mysticism, if anyone is interested in going there and delving into that. If you Google Harvest for Life, it's the first one, that practically the first thing that comes up on the list of sites.
Oh, I'm not getting the first word. Something for life.
Harbor is like a ship's harbor. Harbor, H-A-R-B-O-R, harbor.
Okay, for life.
You know, like a ship goes into a harbor.
Sure. Yeah, I guess my Midwestern ears weren't quite getting the Eastern.
Yeah, there's a little static on the line, too. There's a lot of rain going on.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's what I hear, that the Northeast, and actually then the Southeast, too, has been getting more than its share of rain.
There's a lot of rain, a lot of atmospheric disturbance tonight, you know.
Oh, I wonder.
So now on Gurdjieff, it's interesting because somebody on Facebook told me about a book that was written comparing the work of Gurdjieff and Wilhelm Reich, and I did order that on on my Kindle. It's very, very inexpensive. It was written, you know, several decades ago, and I haven't gotten too far into it yet. But
that's going to be interesting.
Yeah. I'm doing some reading on that, but like I said, I don't have as much facility. Well, I mean, many, many years ago when I was in college, a few people were telling me about Uspensky, you know, and I read a brief biography of his, and so, you know, these topics are the kinds of things that are, it's like a seamless web. One thing leads to the other, but the underlying common denominator to my way of thinking is, that there's more to reality than we are equipped to perceive, either by virtue of the way we are constructed or designed, whether it be by nature, by God, or by some other race of beings. You know, our consciousness is limited, and you know, I'm always looking for ways to expand my consciousness and gain new insight. And there's a very interesting fact. In recent years, the cosmologists and the quantum physicists, and those are usually considered two pretty hard sciences, and the average person doesn't automatically make any connection between that and metaphysics or mysticism. But actually, quite a few books have been written by physicists involved in these areas. But there was one fact that came out, which is that the cosmologists have discovered that the universe is filled with this expanding energy, which Wright called overgrown energy. But even more interesting than that is the fact that 75% of the universe is made up of dark energy. That's not energy. We can't see that dimension, but we can register it indirectly, and they have instruments and ways of being able to register that, mainly because what's happening in the universe cannot be accounted for by the measurable gravity and some of the force in operation. So they discovered that 75% of it is dark energy, and then you have 20-some-odd percent of it is dark matter, and then the rest of it is atomic matter. So the reality that we perceive is only about 6% of the universe. In other words, our reality, it's really because it's actually people think it's the other way around, but it isn't. Our reality is really just the tip of the iceberg. And if you think about metaphysics, and some physicists say there are 11 more dimensions, then we are really perceiving and living in only a small segment of the total metaphysical reality of the universe, which means what's going on in all these other dimensions and in all of this other reality, and that tends to validate a lot of the mysticism and the paranormal and UFO stuff, because where is all this coming from? And my feeling is it's coming out of this other reality. It's like there's little rips in the fabric surrounding us, and we can see out a little bit into the wider world.
It's so exciting.
To me, that's...
Yeah.
It's exciting because it definitely tends to validate what the old occult scientists, you know, men like Gurdjieff and Regardet and others and the mystics and so on, what they were trying to get through, what they were trying to communicate, and their experiences. And then, you know, people said, well, you know, these people are crazy, and you know, what are they talking about, and you know, and then you had materialism came along and said, well, we don't know what these guys are talking about. You had this mechanical science that came along that, you know, they were counting how many cells are in a particular organ, or you know, how fast you can throw a ball, or you know, things that you can, they prided themselves, because they were anti-spiritual, so they prided themselves on the most mundane physical things. They thought that that's all that you could really count on in reality. But now that science, right.
Yeah, it was such a new...
So we can see there's a lot more there, and now the scientists have caught up to the mystics and the occult scientists who have been operating in this dimension going back to the ancient Egyptians.
Yeah. Oh, I think, and this show, I am so glad you're going to be doing this, because there is no end to what can be touched on with all connections. So I'm really looking forward. And the first show is tomorrow at 5 o'clock Eastern.
5 o'clock, yeah. And, well, I'll just get on it and basically talk about a lot about what we talked tonight, just describing it. And then I'm going to we'll go to work recruiting guests. I have one guy I met at a conference in 1997 on Wilhelm Reich's work, Peter Robbins. And Peter Robbins has devoted his life to UFO studies. And he wrote a book called Left at Eastgate, which is a very famous UFO incident in Randlesham Forest in Great Britain
in the
early 80s.
We can talk about him and, some other potential guests. But like you said, tomorrow is going to be just pretty much more of this and some other areas that we may venture into. So I'm very excited.
Right. There's other areas. And there's even a very big political dimension to all this work.
For sure. So, you and I can't be on a show for very long without bringing politics in. So,
in this case, it's real because the power structure has interfered with this from day one.
Right.
You know.
So, Steve, thank you so much, and I'll see you tomorrow at
5 o'clock.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Ruth.
Bye.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay.
Hey, we've talked to Ken Withrow and Steve Katz, whose new show starts this week. Now we're going right on to Sarit Jacobson. Hi, Sarit.
Hi.
Hi. There's so much, like you said, so much is happening in Palestine and Israel. And it was just like 2 hours before the show, I sent you a message and a thing because I was just like coming undone. I had just seen that yesterday some terrorists exploded Gaza's Ark, the boat, and it's like half sunk. This was a boat, an old fishing boat that had been being repaired, and the idea being that this, instead of, you know how the convoys are all, trying to bring things into Gaza. And this one was going to be, and it's still going to happen, I don't care what they say, but this was going to be taking things from Gaza to sell, whether it was flowers or food, whatever, because Gaza has been cut off from selling products. And so this was part of the Freedom Flotilla Coalition. They were fixing up this boat. And, I mean, I've seen the pictures. It's a beautiful boat. There was a night guard aboard it. And at 3:45 a.m., he received a call telling him to leave the boat because it was going to be attacked. And he did leave, but nothing happened. He returned in a few minutes, and then there was a large explosion. And the damage is extensive. Part of the boat is on the ground, or on the floor. It's very shallow because this was right in the harbor. So the whole thing hasn't been sunk, but one end is resting on the seabed. So I don't have really words for this. I don't know. It was such a, a symbol of hope, Sarit. Is that what I'm trying to say? I mean, just the idea that there would be a boat that was going to be seaworthy and...
Yeah, Operation Heal Hope, I call it.
Yeah. And it was just like, oh my God. But, like they say, and it makes me always tear up, you can sink the boat, whatever, but you can't sink the movement. And that, I think, is what we have to remember, that the movement to free Palestine is on. And it's going to come out on top, so to speak. Just, we need for it to happen now. But you were finding out, because you've been talking to so many Israelis, and I'm so glad, because the language, so you can just, you talk with them, and you've been finding out that were really surprising you.
Yes, so absolutely. I don't know why I keep getting surprised. I'm surprised by the amount of oppression going on in Israeli society. I'm starting to see them both as oppressed people under the same government.
Yes.
Since the Israelis are suffering hunger, I'm not sure even who is more hungry right now, and I'm not exaggerating. I think they're both going hungry. According to the Israeli report, almost 900,000 people went without food for a few days.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Israel.
There is no,
I mean, in Israel we had, like, how many people burned themselves? Sorry about my English language. I think about 10 people burned themselves in Israel because of economic oppression.
Right. Right, because we at one point thought that that was just, and I shouldn't say just, but like Buddhist monks would do that to protest. And then during Occupy, we had a couple people in Spain and Greece. I know there was an older couple and somebody else. And then, well, of course, what started the whole Arab Spring, that young man in Tunisia self-immolated.
And the few others that we didn't get to hear about, like the one in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, that's right. And but we didn't hear anything about Israel. We didn't imagine that Israelis were doing this, but you say about 10 people now that you're aware of.
Yeah, including a woman.
That's such a terrible thing.
Very rare to hear of women doing that. I wonder why.
That's it. I mean, I can't imagine myself killing myself, okay? But I understand when people do, and they do something, I guess usually men will shoot themselves and women will take like an overdose of sleeping pills or something, whatever. But the idea of dousing yourself with gasoline or something and setting yourself on fire, I mean, it's like, how
very
bad?
Depression.
Really? I mean, how horrible must life be to do this?
Oh, yes. Very horrible, I'm sure. Israel has some of the highest prices in the world, not highest salaries. It's very hard to survive there. It's so hard that my friend was telling me he can see people eat out of the trash. A lot of young girls sell themselves to prostitution to help feed their families. IDF is losing a lot of soldiers, not because of the occupation, just people have to work, you know, so they escape the army to go work somewhere.
Okay, well, that makes sense, to help their families eat. And there again, like we think about people, or maybe in the cities in this country, and then we think about Southeast Asia and different places again where women are a commodity and, you know, selling themselves for whatever to feed. But there again, we don't think about it in Israel because the press, the mainstream media, anyway,
Israel looks okay. It's not.
I mean, you see the pictures of the tourist towns, like on the Mediterranean Sea, and, you know, you've got sea, you've got sky, it's all beautiful, it's all wonderful. And it's like any other country that's what you see. And, you know, like when I was in Belize, it was like, my God, you know, it's so supposed to be so gorgeous and so this and that. Well, yeah, but if you just get a few miles away from the coast, you see the real
Yes, I advise
country.
Any tourist not to go to South Tel Aviv. It's very dangerous at night.
Wow.
I'm serious. A woman was raped there in front of the cameras, you know, the cameras they have everywhere. And when she went to the police and told the police about it, they put the rape online, on a porn site. I'm serious, no joke. My friend is a lawyer who deals with this stuff, and she always tells us about cases she's getting.
Yeah, it's so despicable. I really don't have words for that. I mean,
there's no, that's like the worst thing ever I've ever heard. I mean, one of the worst things I've ever heard, ever.
No, I mean, God, how horrible to be raped in the first place. Okay, that's such an invasion.
Totally.
And painful psychologically, physically, everything. Then to find out it's on camera, and then you think, well, okay, at least that will help them catch the person who.
Yeah.
You know, so you
but
say, okay,
drop
I mean,
the case or something, want, and
right. It's like I don't want everybody watching this, but can you just like put his face there so you know he can be caught? But then they put it on a porn site. I mean, this,
it's a very violent society as a whole.
That is sick. So that I mean,
isn't it?
That's sick. Yeah. I don't even know what to say.
I was horrified. I saw that in the morning. I couldn't even comprehend how terrible the crime is. I'm very glad that the people who are, there's a wonderful lawyer lady in Israel that is going to try and do see what she can do about it. I have no idea.
I hope that she can, besides the actual rapist who definitely needs to be caught and arrested and doing time, the people that put this on the porn site need to also be doing
time.
I mean, I hope so.
I will
do that.
I will go see what happened in that case. I'm checking right now. I'm finding from the same lovely activist girl that the Jews of Tunisia were taken to concentration camp in World War II, too. I didn't know. Interesting.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't I knew nothing about that. Wow.
I guess they don't want us to know that.
Well, now that's sort of surprising, though, that they wouldn't talk about that.
Isn't it? I have the information I could send you about it.
Yeah. Okay. There's please, because that's Yeah,
it's in French. I'll share it on my wall right now. Yeah. In 1942. And there's pictures, so you can all see it.
Okay. Yeah, there's so much that we're finding out history-wise now that we were never taught. And it doesn't necessarily, well, it doesn't make us any fonder of certain parts of history, but it connects up. So we say, oh, okay, then that was probably why this happened. And, you know, now with this new Cold War we're beginning with Russia, and I don't know if the other Cold War ever really ended. I don't think so, but, you know, they said it was an end to the Cold War, yada, yada, yada. But now it seems like some of these people are just determined to get it going again. So I don't know. I mean, it seems like there's always something and not always good.
Another thing, the driver of Mr. Netanyahu has been caught with child porn.
Oh, yes, yes. I saw it, yeah.
And they knew it when they hired him. First time. I'm looking at the article in Hebrew right now. He is also suspect of being with children.
Mm.
Children 8 to 12 years old.
Okay.
Right.
You know, I'm not... No, I know people will fight me on it, but I'm like, okay, if a girl's 17 and the boy is 19,
yeah, I know what you mean.
And it's
but 8? Wow.
12, but we're talking about children, 8 to 12. No, no, no. That's just a no-go. No, no.
it seems to have an epidemic of rape and pedophilia there, their biggest rock star that plays on the radio all the time was caught with a bunch of kids, and he's not even one day in jail. I mean, 11 years old. It's a kid.
And not even a day in jail?
Not even a day. And I get so sick, YouTube keeps offering me to watch his videos, and I just want to throw up. And I see like a million plays on each video. You can see how many plays.
Oh, God.
And my girlfriend, I have a girlfriend from Israel that I talk to every day for hours, who is says that the girls in her work are all in love with him. And it's so hard for her to be around those girls because it just feels like the Twilight Zone to her.
Yeah. I mean, after you know, he's been with, you know, that he prefers like 11-year-olds.
And he had a prostitution ring.
Oh,
and
well.
Dad was in it with him.
Oh, well.
Serious, it's no joke. His name's Eyal Golan. You can Google Eyal Golan and see. That's their biggest rock star. I don't get it.
A family business.
As a woman, I don't see why the girls like him.
Well, you know what, though, Sri? It's that same syndrome, maybe, in this country, and probably other countries, but in this country, you see, a lot of these guys that are doing life in prison have all these women nuts about them, writing to them, visiting them, and, you know, like proposing to them. I mean, what is it? You know this guy's never going to get out of prison, and so you want to marry him so that you can get, you know, visitation maybe once a month or something with him for a couple hours. I mean, what? Why are they so attractive? Murderers that are, you know, in for life, truly, they're not going to get out. And yet these women just fall all over themselves. So that's sort of like your friends' coworkers. I mean, we there's something about like the bad boy thing. You know, women like the bad boys, like the men like the bad girls. But we're talking not murderers and child rapists and things. We're not talking about that kind of bad boys. We're just talking about somebody that might do something that might be a little illegal or whatever. But this is ridiculous. I'm with your girlfriend. I mean, that must be just sort of hard to, I mean, what does she talk with these people about? If they're drooling over this sex criminal, God, that's too bizarre.
That's happening to the Israeli girls. I want you all to know that what is happening to the Palestinian girls should be 100 times worse. Those men get permission to go into those girls' homes in the middle of the night with impunity.
And do whatever, with impunity, I mean, so they're taking out the brothers, the young boys, and hauling them off. And in the meantime, they're doing whatever they want to with the women. And some of the women are never going to publicly admit it because they feel shame. And
even in America, most girls that get raped don't tell.
Yeah, that's very common. Because,
so imagine.
You know, I mean, here, you go through the trial and you get, you know, the whole thing. And then in Israel, we've talked before, like about that one woman that took it to court and they made her get down on her hands and knees. In the position.
Oh yeah, my other friend took it to court too, and they abused her, and they invited her to police investigations, and she's the victim, she said it was going through a second rape.
So that's the reason why a lot of women don't report it, because
I talk to Israeli women every day. It's very. I leave the chat on and let them all, you know, all chat. We have huge chat. Yeah, it's good to know what is happening. I thought it was just the Palestinians, and now I don't know who I feel more sorry for. The Israeli women seem terrified to even go outside sometimes.
Yeah.
And it's from the occupation. And the bigger picture of the occupation, I believe, is capitalism.
I agree. If you don't have all this fight to make money off of arms, and just like the IDF is testing out new killing horses, if you don't have that, you know, I mean, there's something about the greedy, the corporations, the families that rule the world.
The families that profit on the occupation of Palestine. All you have to do is go to a site called Who Profits.
Ah, Who Profits, okay.
It's a non-profit organization. I don't know who belongs to, but I love it. It's great. For example, Who Profits. We have a lot of Ahava, a company called Ahava for cosmetics. They profit on the occupation.
Yeah.
Oh, they have SodaStream. So we already know, and there's protests.
SodaStream. Hello?
Yeah, I'm thinking who else profits. The bulldozer manufacturer, Volvo.
Caterpillar.
They also profit on the occupation. I didn't know it's Volvo, but I should have known. So there's a lot of companies who profit on that site. A great site, perfect, perfectly run, with care.
Right.
Another thing, the settlers have been very violent lately, more than ever. Their violence is even more extreme. They've been destroying mosques and writing graffiti in mosques.
Their mosque. Yeah, they actually they tore it down.
There was one they tore down, and many others they put graffiti on. No one really knows what's really happening. I get different reports. Oh, I forgot to tell you about the report of terrible brutality beating up Palestinian women in the Hebrew University in Israel. The police during a protest and beat up just the Palestinian women 2 days ago. They're so cruel.
Yeah, it takes a real man, doesn't it, to beat up
somebody. They make me laugh at them. And the settlers tried to steal a wheelchair from a kid who is not able to walk without assistance. They're just insane. We're not talking about any... It's like a bad cult, not Jewish. It's like Jewish gone wrong. I don't know if it's Jewish. As far as I know, it isn't.
It's Zionism, and Zionism is not. It's a political entity. It has nothing to do with religion or culture.
Exactly. Albert Einstein said it was like Nazis, compared it to Nazism, by the way. So...
Well,
way back then, in 1948.
Even way before that, like the Zionists and the Nazis worked together.
That's what Albert Einstein said, and I think he's one of the smartest people alive, so don't even have to research it too much to see that he's
right. So it's nothing like...
As soon as Israel started... Anyone with dark skin got treated as a third-class citizen. Babies were taken away from their moms. They still are. In Israel, they will take a baby away from the mom if it's poor and give it to a rich family.
Ah, so money, again, capitalism, the inequalities.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
Donald Sterling said black people in Israel are treated like dogs, he was wrong. They're treated much worse than dogs.
Oh, well, yes. That's the one thing. We've got a good vegan movement there. It's very racist. And you know, there again, when they show the pictures of the, the tourists, the seaside resort or something, you'll see different colors people. You know, it's just, and you know, if it's like an advertisement in a gay magazine or something, you'll see the guys together and everybody just looks so happy. But like you said, that in the country itself, that's not exactly, it's not really that easy. It's not, they're not that tolerant or liberal or anything. So
depends where you are, but it's, there've been definitely a lot of taking away babies from people. Yeah, racism is high. Hate crime is high. I'll never forget about the baby that was stabbed a few months ago. 6-month-old baby. It was from Eritrea. I guess they don't like dark-skinned babies. Somebody didn't like it. The whole government itself is racist. They call foreigners cancer. That's a Nazi term. That's what the Nazis called the Jews.
Ah, so really, I mean, it is another form of Nazism. Zionism is. I mean, when they're even using the same words, come on.
Same words. When they call the poor people that escape from their war in Africa cancer and escaping a Holocaust there, I just get very angry at the Israeli leaders for talking like that, yes. Very angry. It's not supposed to do that.
Well, of course not. I mean, just any kind of human decency would.
Yeah, I get too angry to speak.
You know.
Too angry to think. I just get mad. Yeah.
That's it. I mean, well, that's it. And you know, I mean, we both meditate. We both do, you know, these things to keep the blood pressure down.
Calm us down, yeah.
But it gets to us, and that's when we have to, like, you paint, you go for a walk with the dogs. I just get offline. I go do something. I compost, since the soil's too wet for my neighbor to till it up for me yet, so I compost, and I, you know, dig around with the compost. But, I mean, we have to get away from it, and I mean, everybody does who gets deeply into this, because otherwise they're going to go crazy, truly.
I'm getting back at them right now. I was painting the soldiers, and I made them look really silly, and I painted one of the soldiers leaving the protest and kissing one of the protesters.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we need. We need to see, you know, people being human. And say,
I'm
going to
get back to doing art, I decided. Yeah, I hope so.
Exactly. With your actual painting and then music, you can do that.
It's a great hobby, and I recommend it to everyone, really. It's a great release.
Well, Ryan, people don't have to be talented like you to just get some kind
thank
of...
Thank you. I don't feel...
Medium.
I just feel... Yeah, thank you.
And you know, something to put it on and just go for it. Actually, I've been thinking about that myself because...
Good for your health.
Yeah, I agree. And hey, you know, we've got to take care of ourselves in order to keep our strength and energy up to do what we need to do for the world. So that's very good advice. Yeah. So
it's easier to get to people through music than to talk to them.
Yeah. Well, I believe Sarit Jacobson Art.
Yeah.
It's one site, and also Sarit Jacobson on Facebook, and from there you can go around and find out, see what you're doing, and just to see what you're doing besides the art too. So,
sure, a lot of things. About Palestine on my wall every day.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And because you can get things from the Hebrew sites too. I mean, the in the Hebrew language, and you can translate or. You know, if we go to certain of those sites, it comes up and says, this is in Hebrew, do you want it in English? And we can click yes. So it's all out there. We just have to...
Yeah, Breaking the Silence is in English, and if you're looking for it, it's on my wall, so you can go straight to the site from my wall.
Right.
YouTube made it hard to find, you know. So you have to go to the word Shovrim to find it, Shovrim.
Okay, Sarit, that's it for tonight, and we'll see you back here next Wednesday. Send me whatever and I'll put it on the page, and I'll put it around other pages too. So
great.
Thank you so
thank
much, George.
Thank you so much.
And
great. Thank you.
Ken George.